that they wanted to give. It's up to them. But that I wanted them to maintain their track changes in separate files, so they didn't re-save over them, right? And I will pay them twice. One for the archive, one for the book. Because the archive is worth more to scholars than the book. The book is a commodity form meant for a very small user base, basically. Whereas we as scholars would have so much we could do out of a self-curated, thoughtfully constructed, multi-layer novel. For every novel, can you imagine? You could even imagine that the more robust reader who wants that information would actually pay the paywall to get into the scholarly version and so on. So it's, and they have it all. It's all there. It's just that they don't save, you know, and refile me. They'll just save over, killing history every time, you know. And so I believe that if, you know, the demand is raised even somewhat, actually the economy will take care of this problem because it will be necessary, and people will want more money and want more prestige and go through very simple steps to do so. So I think that is it, except for what I hope will be our conversation.
Well, thank you so much. I think we are on time. So, we actually have 20 minutes for the Q&A, and now the floor is open. Anybody has any question for Jonathan, Alexa?
Thank you, Jonathan, for this brilliant talk. You mentioned the difficulty of archiving, the necessity and difficulty of archiving material. Can you comment on censorship and what we might call archival silence, either because of censorship or because of difficulty of acquiring material? If donating papers would cost 30,000, maybe some poets cannot, or their executives cannot afford that, and so we slip into obscurity. And all of those factors.
So two basic questions. The first one around, I would group censorship and privacy issues as being, you know, so judgment calls, we'll call them, complex, hard case judgment calls in terms of what to make public and not public, is the first one. And then back to the kind of problem of the overcoming these hurdles to get papers into safe collections. Okay. So the first one is interesting and really daunting. You know, I mean, I spend a lot of time in legal counsel, you know, talking about what, you know, whether universities are indemnified against lawsuits, you know, raised. Because what happens when you get living authors and you're collecting them is you're collecting correspondence between two people. And typically, you only collect the part of that that's coming from someone else. In other words, people are not getting, I mean, some people will, authors will, because again, they're getting paid for this stuff, sometimes make a copy up there. They'll have a carbon copy when they're doing a typewriter, or they'll actually have a facsimile copy or something like that of their handwritten letter to so-and-so, something like that. So you can see both sides of correspondence. But, you know, translators aren't going to do that. So you see the letters from other people to them. Yeah. And so how do you deal with the privacy? And the answer is that material is owned by the person who it is given to. And they can give that ownership over to an institution. And you have to write, you know, you have to sign the proper, you know, legal framework to do so. Mm-hmm. But you know, that does indemnify, you know, the university from lawful claim or lawsuits that might arise from making certain things public. So keep that in mind. But the next answer is much more like moral than legal in nature. So you know, when you're dealing with Taiwan and mainland China and the U.S., you know, you are dealing with politics. You are dealing with the potential harm. To friends and family and so on. So, you know, what should be public record and not? You know, so there are, let's say, hypotheticals where you might have an author who's talking about, you know, saying something in a private way, you know. But as soon as it's in an archive and published, and I'm going to talk about publishing, I forgot to key that. It is a form of publishing. Then it becomes kind of like a public statement, even though it was made in a private context. And so what do you do with that? Can it be harmful to a person? And I think the answer is going to be, yeah, sure, I think it can be, right? So the curator, as well as the scholar, has a moral obligation. But here's the catch, too. The scholar's not indemnified. So they could be sued. So let's say you go to the archive and you find something juicy, about that talks about censorship or some kind of political issue that you know, and this person's a famous person, you know, and you go and you you cite that in your research, you can be sued by that author because you are the one making it public. So it's actually not publishing. This is fascinating to me. And in my years out, I want to formally create publishing instruments inside archive, because actually you need forms of dissemination, not just open access, to, you know, and so on. But they're not published. Therefore, you're not making, you know, you're not able to be sued. But if someone puts it into a book that is disseminated, then that's your call, and you can get called out, you know, and so on. So that kind of thing has to be understood, I guess, when you're doing research on living writers, as far as I understand it, this situation. But the curator also can make calls. If something looks injurious, you know, often the donor, I have things in my archive which are only post, you know, after death, these can be made public, but not people. You know, so there are certain things that are written contractually that this can be only made public after I'm dead, and or in 50 years or things like that, right? So we're in DC, we're used to that kind of thing. But that that also comes in some of the deeds of gift, that kind of special language. So the second question has to do with the high bar of getting your work saved and so on. And if any of you are particularly industrious and want to start a company on this, you know, I think that there's lots of things. The space is unmade. Lots of things that we can do, lots of instruments we can create to create an organizational frame, you know, like tools that could help translators do this work and essentially prepare minimize the labor is my advice to the curator and their staff and archivists. So if you self-curate because you, have instruments that you can go ahead and have chronological, you can do tagging, you can tag everything that's in there and so on. You build an archive and you will find a home for it, because most of the cost is born in the cataloging process and the indexing process, the cross-referencing process. Okay, so when you have a letter from someone and, you know, and that references a particular event you know, whatever, you pull that out as a tag and you might find that you have over your career many tags of the, you know, many times you've tagged that same thing. But if you look at many translators, that tag becomes really important, right? And you can start triangulating and aggregating data. And most of the research tools that we're moving closer toward, of course, are metadata-rich aggregators that rely on that. But the cost of getting to that point adds a new level of prestige to the documents themselves, because there's labor involved in preparing them. So if you can self-prepare, you've actually added value to your work. And it's not very hard, especially if you know the material yourself. So a lot of this goes to the poet, I think, or to the translator and so on. Like in the future, more self-curatorial understanding will mean lower bars to get it preserved and say cited later on. Other than that, simply going and arguing for the importance of a work and figuring out who your special collections directors are, you know, and asking them what kinds of materials they're collecting and so on, you might find that the university doesn't have one of these, you know, pay-to-play policies. But also, you know, I think that this is a big problem for me in the beginning. Should I start the archive in Oklahoma, given that where it's at, and given that we don't have a comparative literature or Chinese literature PhD program? And, you know, these things were a bit concerning. I want them to be landlocked, you know, kind of cut away from and so on. But the more big names you get, the more gravity it has, the more likely it ends up getting digitized and so on. And as I mentioned, you know, I got over it. But you know, that's another thing. You know, I don't know if everybody should go do this, because then you end up with boxes tucked away in closets in universities in Milwaukee. And, you know, and that might not be a good way of preserving either.
My name is Doli, and I'm an undergraduate currently taking Taiwanese literature. And my question would be, because during your speech, like, it was kind of interesting because you mentioned there are like digital archiving website, and also because of like digitalization, people in DC tend not to save their papers because like time or space. So from your work experience in archiving, what do you think digitalization is doing to archiving? Like in general, is a good influence or like a bad one?
Yeah, so bad, but it could be so good. I mean, storage is good. Storage is amazing. I mean, like we should never throw away anything ever again. Like data is now light. You know, I mean, it makes feathers look like they're made of lead. It's amazing. Time and space is completely different. Having said that, the cost of that is the vulnerability of losing your external hard drive or flash drive or whatever actual physical object it was stored upon, which I'm guilty of. Of course, hard drives, you know, on your internal hard drives, you're throwing away your laptop, right? Email systems going from one server to another and wiping out, you know, people's entire archives. Right? I have 65,000 emails, I've yet to download them, because it's very scary, because again, I'm a bad self-archivist, I'm working on it. So good insofar as we should have the tools to make archives much more useful than they've ever been before because of searchability. You know, that there's no reason that big data can't be, not radically disruptive to the humanities, but augment, our own methods and make them, easier to perform, but also probably more rigorous because we're able to just cross-read so much more, vigorously and efficiently than possible in any pre-digital space. Having said that, the value of a digital document is again back to Plato or something like that, but is nil. The handwritten document, Moyan's hand, we just acquired his handwritten letters and manuscripts, and that was an arms race with museums in China, who want that fetish object, to put on display. Moyan wrote Life and Death is War in Miao's 600-page book, 400,000 characters, I think, by hand, on a scroll, with a brush. It's awful. But he understood that. He understood that there was value in that object, And that kind of thing. In Taiwan, this archive culture that's built up is so keen on the paper, because it's great, and you can put it on display, and you can own it. The digital thing doesn't exist in our pre-singularity consciousness or whatever it is. Like, we haven't shifted our means of appreciation to understand the materiality of binary construction, binary code. So I don't know what to do about that. I think that it is negative, principally. Here's another reason. I just acquired a translator, Andrea Linkenfelter, who's translated Mian Mian and other young women writers in China. And I asked her for her email, and she goes, "Oh no, I use WeChat." There's no archive in WeChat. It's gone. Right? So that's a big problem. Storage and the microclimate of mobile, right, devices is different than in laptops and desktops because people don't want to store data. And this stuff is not cloud-oriented, I guess, so it's just gone, and it wouldn't be gone if it was valuable, if people wanted it, and there's no value if it's not wanted, and there's no wanting if you don't know what to do with it. So this is all, I think, small moves in the right direction to start valuing digital information and curating it as well. But just dealing with Howard's email, like, I haven't received the email yet, because, it's hard for him to go through it and figure out what he wants to say but not say. And I hope he does, because if he hands me his hard drive, I don't know if anyone, no matter how interested you are in it, wants to go through all that email and figure out what, it's tough. So the abundance of digital data is also a problem. It's hard, but it's searchable, but you still can't get it all. So it's weird. Like, we just haven't evolved very well. As research methods to, and I say all this and I sound like I'm super like big data and metrics and I'm so not, because I value the literary theory, so, and close reading, so, and style so much. I mean, what if we're not stylists and we're writing about literature, then what are we doing, you know? Like, there's got, you know, like, the sense of aesthetic pleasure and doing what we do as literati, you know, is so important to, oh my gosh, I've gone to, you know, these conferences on big data and stuff, and it's great, and I'm like, but, you know, there's a problem. When we move to overestimating the value of searchability and tagging and so on, but it's so good in the balance space. So, sort of an answer, it's a response, not an answer.
Yes. Could you speak louder?
Okay. You mentioned a lot local and small bookstores at the beginning. So do you think the retail bookstore chains like the Aslett, Chupin, Shugian, helping or creating the survival of those rather local bookstores, because those stores not only sell books, they also collect the archives.
Yeah, it's a good question, but I think we're a little bit beyond it in a way, because the digital seller is more of a threat than the 24-hour bookstore, which is its own innovation, right? And does, I think, it has its own problems, you know, resisting the pressures of Amazon and other online book dealing. So used to be not long ago that the big box seller was the one endangering the little box seller or the small bookstore. But now, you know, I think the main threat is has to do with not just e-books but e-culture, attention spans, long form prose, like reading. In a certain sense, these things are also, you know, problem, probably more. So, probably at some level there's competition. But that's what's interesting, is competition is not inherently bad. What I like about the Taiwan situation is that the small bookstores understand their value add in business speak. You know, what their value proposition is to their customer isn't come buy a book, right? It's about the culture inside that space. It's a community that they build, and they always have been. But they didn't always know that's what they were doing, I think. I think that often small bookstores thought they were selling books, not knowing they were selling community. And so what's cool about the, I think, highly advanced self-awareness of the Taiwanese book community is that they're trying to commodify and create economies at this micro scale to promote what they're actually selling, right? Which is a space to collect people, conversations to be had, salons, discussion, discourse, right? And they're understanding there's little microclimates and adapting to them. And that's really, really great, I think, ultimately, because they can be much more robust if that's the case. Which really wonderful, again, to go back to the Taiwan model, is this intersection between charismatic and powerful individuals like Wu Cheng, this poet who's collecting and archiving on his own accord. Often, if politically motivated, you know, or whatever it might be, but still the creating of foundation-oriented archives and museums around Taiwan, usually in the hometown of a well-known writer, because they're community-oriented, they're organizing events there, and they're, regardless of whether they're championing Yang Mu or Liang or Wu Hao and all those, it doesn't really, you know, it's all literature, and it is advocating for reading, it is advocating for literacy and for valuing the arts. And then you have these sort of micro capitalist climates, but then you also have robust support from the government, you know, and that intersection between the government support for not only the archive spaces I talked about, but small grants for the publication of books, of operas, of ballets, and you know, and so on, is really, it's really great. So I think there's much to be happy about, even if they're probably, if I imagine not even one of those bookstore owners would agree, because they shouldn't agree, because it's hard, you know, it's gritty, this is tough. That's what competition does, you know. But I think, from another perspective, the outsider's perspective, it's very inspiring.
Yes.
I wanted to add something on that. Like, how is it like in mainland China, like about the libraries, like books alone? Because like what I feel is from mainland China, we may focus on like Confucianism more, like some classical literature instead of like modern literature, I think. Like, what's your point of view and like what can we learn from each other?
Yeah, great question. So number one, you know, the good news about mainland China is, in terms of translation, is that it is very valued as a high art form. And there are many translation studies programs and so on, and that's good news. Again, methodologically, there's the problem of not having anything to study, you know, when it comes to contemporary practice. But a lot of the focus of the field is on late Qing Dynasty, Republican period, and the lionization of translators, you know, very important cultural figures. And that Confucian sort of, as it were, instinct to understand the generation before and to, you know, to respect it and to, you know, to hold it up and to understand it thoroughly and so on is wonderful, but it's not so good for preserving the translators today, right? And so you won't find the same things that I've described here. But that's also true of Taiwan. Like, Taiwan is also not preserving translators' work. So what I'm talking in this case would be the Chinese translators who are translating work into Chinese or into Tai or whatever. Like, that's not... my job is to do the opposite side, right? Because I have access to those translators. But I don't have access to the Taiwanese translators or the Chinese translators whose work I think is equally valuable to those who they are translating. So the problems I'm describing are the same in all three spaces. So that's important to mention. But to your second point about these kind of climates, literary climates in China, the good news is the bad news you said. That sounds bad. There is good news about what you said was sounded kind of bad in your phrasing, which is that a reverence for classical literature. The good news is that, you know, classical poetry salons are huge, and especially online, and there's a resurgence of interest in classical forms, which I think is really great. But it does, in fact, create a tension in the literary world between modern verse, which doesn't have the claim to Chinese-ness due to its point of origin 100 years ago to this year, celebrations happening right now all year long, 100 years, of Xinshi. So Xinshi it doesn't have that kind of a cultural prestige that the Tangshi and others have. And so that will be a problem that will probably increase rather than decrease. But the problem is also interesting. You know, it has, like, an increase in any literature, I think, is probably not bad, inherently. Here's the good news as well, that modern Chinese poetry and literature is very much alive, you know, and supported by the government as well as by the provinces, as well as by personal, private, and, you know, foundations and so on. So I found there's nothing to fear about poetry in China. It's so robust, and, you know, that despite its marginalization, that's always good for poetry. At some scale, but, you know, there's a lot more funding and interest in poetry, especially in China, than there is in America, by exponents.
Perhaps one last question. Rodney, you want to ask a question?
Okay. So you mentioned some scenario about how if there was a living author that had something in the archive and then someone published that work, they could get sued by the author. I was wondering if you could explain me, like, how an archive isn't automatically public information, and how to navigate, like, if you wanted to use something, and, like, if you have to ask the author's permission, or what that scenario would be like.
Yeah, so that's typically how it works with living authors, right? Is that if you're going to write a scandalous piece, you know, in the literary world, that's not likely. But if you did, you know, that's sort of the expectation, is that you bear, you know, you are the one making that argument or putting that forward. You're taking this out of the whole public collection, right, and making use of that element, which makes you more, I think, liable for the intention of putting it, made it, you know, so making it public versus putting it disseminating it into the public, plucking it out, curating and putting it out, right, is intentional. And that volition, I think, of taking something which is available and making it public is different. And that's the difference between publishing and curating, or collecting, and making it available versus making it public. But this is, like, I'm still learning. Like, I went through my basic kind of legal chat, you know, with our lawyers about how this works, you know, and it's an ongoing discussion. There are not a lot of cases where there's precedent for that my legal counsel is aware of at OU. But, you know, so I can't really answer it more than that. But as I understand it, it is about that kind of volitional act to make something public is not the same thing as making it available to the public. So if you were to publish the entire archive as a book, like take everything that's made available and then disseminate it into the public space, it's already a different kind of act. And I'm very interested in that, you know, because I think that there's a room for libraries to be publishers, and that in the digital age, the difference between these two are legal rather than economic or material, as much as people think. And so there's a space to reimagine what a library is in every way right now, including the possibility of converting essentially monographed, as turned into a, you know, to a verb, scholarship on an archive, and literally not have to go away from the archive, but actually publish that work within it. There's no reason why that can't be done. But then we would be in that question very, you know, in a new way as a publisher.
All right. I guess we have to conclude here because it's 2:06. I would like to thank Professor Jonathan Stalling for his wonderful thought-inspiring talk today. And any question you have, we can carry on the conversation after this. Okay. Thank you so much.